after the show, and then we'll post it at democracynow.org. Professor Theodore Postol of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, thanks so much for joining us. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. democracynow.org is our website. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with host Joanne Hardesty. Today's guest is Edward T. Haslam, author of the recently updated book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, about a secret biology lab in New Orleans and emerging global epidemics.
First chattel slavery, then Jim Crow. Now mass incarceration. Over half of our prison population are people of color. Tune into Prison Pipeline to hear Jonina Abron Irvin and Lorenzo Irvin talk about prison slavery. That's Prison Pipeline, August 4th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Vietnam, an interview, a live performance and book release event on Saturday, August 9th, 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in Portland. The presentation will feature live original music, music videos, dramatic readings, and a discussion with the producers. That's Vietnam, an interview, in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, Saturday, August 9th, 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It is my pleasure to have on the program today Mr. Edward T. Haslam, and we will be talking about his latest update of Dr. Mary's Monkey. Welcome to the program.
Be here.
We are pleased to have you here. This is the third update of this book that you've done since you originally wrote it.
Yes, I started in 1995, my first book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and then in 2007 we expanded that after I found a witness to the biological warfare laboratory that I was writing about. And so in 2007 we came out with Dr. Mary's Monkey, and this 2014 edition has an additional 25 pages. We have the actual crime scene photos, and we have documents from the FBI, CIA, CDC, and the New Orleans Police Department. So I've been at this for about 20 years now.
Yes, it sounds like you have definitely, you're probably the most knowledgeable person about this topic. So tell me, why is the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, who is pretty much an unknown scientist, important to us today, over 50 years later?
She's unknown in the sense that she was not on Dancing with the Stars. You know? Within the medical circles, she was very well known. She was the chair of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, which made her one of the highest-ranking women in American medicine. She was a professor at Tulane Medical School, as was my father. They both taught orthopedic surgery, so my father was both a colleague and friend of Dr. Sherman's. And because of that, I knew things about Dr. Sherman that a lot of people didn't know. Mm-hmm. I knew her background. And my father was out of Harvard, and he had like the utmost respect for this woman who was from the University of Chicago, which is where they developed the first sustained nuclear reaction and all the heavy metal stuff up there. The Enrico Fermi was up there, and he's the guy whose name's on the patent for nuclear power. And so Mary Sherman was working with these people up at the University of Chicago, and she was widely published. She's a wonderful writer, by the way. Widely published in peer-reviewed articles. I mean, journals. Mm-hmm. in two areas. One was cancer, and the other was radiation. So she was an expert in cancer. She ran a cancer laboratory at Ochsner Clinic, and she was an expert in radiation. And she was one of the people bringing radiation into medicine. And so she's a world-class doctor, is the point. And when I heard when I was a child that her right arm had been was missing from her murder. I mean, her murder was discovered in the summer of 1964. It's just been 50 years now. Mm-hmm. And 30 years later, I went, and because, you know, I was told this thing was shut down, you know, the investigation was shut down.
Oh, the investigation was done, it was over. And was the crime solved?
No. In fact, 30 years later, I went down to the library, and I was able to get the autopsy protocol, the police reports, the homicide reports, and all of the newspaper coverage for the 2 weeks after her murder. And what I discovered when I brought all that home and I put it on my kitchen table, and I had the media stack and I had the official document stack, I realized the public was never told what happened to her. What the public was told was that her body was found naked in her the bedroom of her apartment. She was stabbed 7 or 8 times, and somebody set her body on fire.
Whoa.
And that's pretty bad, and it opened the door to a lot of uncharitable rumors, I will say. But when you read through the official documents, I realized that the real problem was that her entire right arm and rib cage had been disintegrated by heat. And the cops on the scene said they could see the internal organs of her body through the hole blown in her rib cage. But her body is identified by her hair. We now have the crime scene photos, and they're in this new book. And you can see the pictures of the body. And I guarantee you, what was going on with Mary Sherman was she was electrocuted by a high-voltage electrocution. And there's nothing in her apartment that could possibly have done the damage to her body.
Wow. So you think maybe that she was returned to her apartment after she was murdered?
Yes, and they faked the murder scene.
Wow.
And what the coroner of the day told the public was that she was stabbed to death, and the cause of death was a stab wound to the heart. Hmm. Well, the sequence that I sort of reassemble from this is she's somewhere else with a very high voltage piece of equipment and doing something fairly secret because nobody knows about it, all right?
Right.
And she gets electrocuted. This thing burns off her arm and rib cage, but the electricity does not cross her heart. So somebody is with her, probably a doctor, and they see her. I mean, she's not going to want to wake up from this. I mean, she's blind. 20% of her body is gone. She's not going to survive in the first place. They decide to terminate her with a mercy killing. So they carefully stab her with a very slim instrument directly in the heart to terminate her. And we know she's alive when that wound is there because there's like 1,200 cc's of blood in the pericardium sac around the heart. And then they go and get a body bag. They put her in the body bag. They take her back to her apartment, put her on her bed. She's actually upside down with the feet in the wrong direction. And she's stiff at this point because it's been hours since she actually died and rigor mortis is setting in. Then they pile a bunch of underwear, that neatly folded underwear, they take out of her top drawer and put that on there, and they stab her at that point through the underwear because there are V-cuts in the underwear. So we know she was stabbed there at that time, and one of those stab wounds goes into her liver. Now, it does not bleed, or hemorrhage, as they say in medicine.
Right.
You bleed when you're alive. You don't bleed when you're dead. So those two sets of stab wounds, the heart and the liver and the other 6 or 7 on her body, did not occur at the same time. Hmm. And then they set a fire. They pour some lighter fluid or something on the underwear and throw a match on it and leave. They set the fire to create some form of explanation for the burns on her body. But the only thing, and we have the photos now of the of her bedroom after the fire, and the curtains next to her bed didn't burn. The books on her nightstand didn't burn. The wooden furniture didn't burn. Nothing really except the mattress burned, and mattress fires don't burn off arms. I mean, it's really that simple. So,
tell our audience, who was Dr. Mary Sherman?
Dr. Mary Sherman was an orthopedic surgeon in New Orleans who was an expert in cancer and radiation, and she was murdered at the age of 51 in 1964. She was a beautiful, respected, well-educated woman.
And
she had a horrible death.
Yes, yeah. Horrible end. This is true. And she was involved in research, animal research, looking for cures to cancer, soft tissue cancer. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but let me rephrase this whole thing. The real problem here, and your question, why do we care about this today?
Mm-hmm.
We have a cancer epidemic today
right. In
America. And just ask anybody you know, is there anybody in your friend or family circle with cancer? And the answer is yes. Okay?
Right.
And where did this come from? And when I started asking all the questions about Mary Sherman, where is she from, who does she work for, who did she go to med school with, who did she know, and digging into this, the trail goes back to the polio vaccine in the 1950s. Because the polio vaccine was grown on monkey kidney cells. And researchers at the up in your neck of the woods from Maryland originally, up at NIH, two of them, Bernice Eddy and Sarah Stewart, discovered a cancer-causing virus in 1957, which caused multiple types of cancer in multiple animals. It named it polyoma. Congress started throwing a lot of money in their direction. Everyone was getting electron microscopes. They started cataloging all of the viruses in the monkey labs. And they finally realized in 1959 that they traced the polyoma back to the rhesus monkey. They renamed it. They called it SV40. S stands for simian, which means monkey. Okay, SV40. And the problem was they had used the kidneys of the rhesus monkey to grow the polio vaccine. And all of the viruses from the monkey's kidneys got into the polio vaccine.
Wow.
And they realized in 1959 that there was a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine after they had already released 100 million doses.
Wow.
And they still had 100 million on the shelf. This is like the biggest mistake in history. And
that almost no one knows about.
That's right. The people that did know did not want the public to know.
Right.
I mean, there's an accountability issue here.
That's right.
And so they did two things. One is they stamped it secret, and a very Orwellian thing, started telling us viruses could not cause cancer, which is kind of weird because Time Magazine, 1959, the cover article was about cancer-causing viruses.
Wow.
But then they tell us that it can't cause virus because you can't have a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine if you don't have a cancer-causing virus. But nowadays, of course, they're marketing the HPV vaccine to stop the human papillomavirus from cervical cancer in women and other cancers in men.
Right.
So they can no longer say cancers, viruses don't cause cancer because they're out there marketing a cancer-causing vaccine.
Right.
And so they got, in addition to stamping it secret, what did they do once they knew? They got really busy trying to develop a anti-cancer vaccine. And the detail of the story of the polio vaccine helps a lot with this, because in April of 1959, there was a big press conference up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where they announced the results of the Francis trials, which said that the polio vaccine was safe and effective, and roll up your sleeves and get ready for your inoculation. And then at the last minute, they turned to Dr. Bernice Eddy at NIH and said, please approve these. We have to release them. And she took them back and put them into her monkeys, and she got back dead and crippled monkeys. And she said, look, there's a problem here. Don't release this thing. And she said, it's all coming out of one batch. It's the Cutter Laboratories batches where the problem is. And so they contacted Cutter Laboratories, and the major stockholder in Cutter Laboratories was Dr. Alton Ochsner in New Orleans, who was the boss of Mary Sherman. She ran a cancer lab at his hospital, and told him to, you know, ask him to withdraw his thing. And he said, no, I've known Jonas Salk for 20 years and stuff. And he was chief of surgery at the time at Tulane Medical School, and he called the faculty into the amphitheater, Mary Sherman and my father being in the audience, and said, look, there's a controversy over this, and I would never ask you to do something I wasn't willing to do myself. And these are my grandchildren. Here's my grandson. Here's my granddaughter. I'm going to inoculate him right here, right now. Which he did. And in 72 hours, his grandson was dead, and his granddaughter got polio.
Wow.
And so that put that man in very close personal contact with this story, okay? He was also the president of the American Cancer Society. So when they discovered the cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine, he was the logical person to go to say, we need somebody with courage and knowledge to help develop a vaccine to stop this cancer epidemic before it starts. And Salk's vaccine, by the way, got withdrawn. This is something a lot of people don't know. He's got such great PR, you know, the Salk Institute, La Jolla, all that stuff. He retires as a hero, even though his vaccine backfired on launch. And then that vaccine was replaced by the Sabin vaccine. And the difference between the two is polio has like heavy, medium, and light strains. And Salk said, well, heavy is the only one that kills and cripples, so I'm going to deactivate it by drowning it in formaldehyde. And that didn't work out in the production phase, and which is why his vaccine got removed. Sabin said, don't mess with that heavy thing. That's the one that causes all the problems. Use polio light, because it causes the same immune response, but it doesn't kill or cripple. So Sabin left the polio virus alive in the polio vaccine. And so his vaccine was also grown on monkey kidney cells. And so the SV40 and SIV, which I'll talk about in a bit, were both in both vaccines. And so his started out being a injectable syringe vaccine and wound up being the famous sugar cube of the 50s and 60s that a lot of people of that age remember. And it was, you know, later that they figured out that it was in the vaccine. So they say, we've got to make a vaccine, but we don't have an SV40 light. We only have SV40 heavy. How do we get SV40 to mutate into a more benign strain that we can use for a vaccine? Well, the answer is radiation.
Mm.
So they set up a radioactive laboratory with a linear particle accelerator designed by High Voltage Engineering in Boston. They install this on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, which is federal property. And there's about 13 buildings on this campus, and it's no longer owned by the federal government. But it's about 13 buildings, a big hospital in the center, and then they had a bunch of smaller buildings in the back. One of these smaller buildings is where they put the linear particle accelerator, and they named it the Infectious Disease Laboratory, just keep out the casual traffic.
right. Yeah, you wouldn't want to walk in that door, right?
That's right. And so there they are exposed. They've got a linear particle accelerator set up. It's shooting its beam down to the ground, and they have a platinum pyramid down there, which is dividing the beam up into equal doses so they can put test tubes around it and hit all the test tubes with the same dosage at the same time. And this is 1960-61. They've got all these world-class experts working on this and down in New Orleans. It's hidden. It's like a medical Manhattan project because they don't want to tell the public what they're doing or why they're doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you know, you start asking the questions, why are you mutating monkey viruses? And the answer leads back to, we just mass inoculated the entire country with a cancer-causing virus. And then, just because reality is stranger than fiction, but what happens at this point is Castro takes over Cuba. And the U.S. slaps an embargo on Cuba, and the business in New Orleans is trade.
Right.
And that knocks out 25% of the trade in New Orleans. Then Castro's talking about taking the revolution to Central and South America. Well, if he does that, there go the bananas and there go the coffee beans.
Right.
And then in come the Russian missiles. And Cuba now has Russian nuclear warheads on intermediate-range missiles pointed at the United States, and when you draw the big circle on the map of what they can reach, New Orleans is right inside the circle.
Right.
So this is the Cold War. This is the anti-communist hysteria, the red fear and all that stuff. And we know now that the CIA, which was all over New Orleans because of the trade, and the mafia were working together to kill Fidel Castro. And if you don't know, there's quite a bit of mafia in New Orleans, too, okay? So what happens is the decision is made to use this facility that nobody knows about that's using the radiation, because they're getting back stronger and stronger viruses instead of weaker and weaker ones. They decide to use that to weaponize the cancer-causing viruses to make a biological weapon to kill Fidel Castro. And in order to do this, they're going to inject mice with this cancer-causing virus, see which mice grow the fastest tumors, because that's going to be the most aggressive virus. Then they'll kill those mice and cut out the tumors and throw them into a blender, put them back into a test tube, send them back for more radiation, and create a loop. And they're doing this in safe houses, you know, in suburban parts of New Orleans where nobody would suspect anything like this going on.
Right.
And one of these houses has about 2,000 mice in it, and a couple of Cuban men taking care of the mice. And they take them across the street to David Ferry's apartment. And David Ferry is Jim Garrison's main suspect in the JFK investigation there. And I have to introduce somebody else because she's an important part of the story. She's the witness that 60 Minutes brought me. And I got a phone call in the year 2000 from 60 Minutes, and they said that they had been investigating a woman for over a year who kept telling them that she was the laboratory technician in the underground medical laboratory that I had written about in 1995. My original book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory, it introduced this idea of the secret biological warfare laboratory organized in David Ferry's apartment. But I did not have a witness.
Mm-hmm.
And so 60 Minutes says, this woman keeps telling us that she is the witness that did this work. Do you want to meet her and or talk to her? I said, yes, of course.
Of course, right.
Yeah. So I get to know this woman, and I get to know her whole story, and I'm eventually asked by my publisher to edit her book and do a timeline on her entire life. So I have vetted this woman, like, really thoroughly. And what you discover about her was when she was in middle school, her grandmother dies of cancer, and she decides that she wants to be the person who finds the cure for cancer. That's what she is going to devote her life to.
Mm-hmm.
And so in high school, she starts doing cancer experiments. And by the time she's a senior in high school, she's getting all kind of help from all kind of really powerful people in the Army and all kind of stuff. But by the time she's a senior in high school, she's giving cancer to mice in 7 days. Now, this is faster than they're doing it at NCI.
Wow.
And when the head of the leadership of the American Cancer Society discovers that they have a high school girl in a dirt floor laboratory with no budget who's outperforming NCI,
right.
They scoop her up. You know, and they say, you know, we're shutting down your lab because this is like you're playing with fire here, but we want to teach you how to do this right. And we're sending you up to Buffalo, New York, to the Roswell Park Cancer Institute up there. And you're going to work in the director's laboratory for the summer. And we're going to teach you how to handle cancer-causing viruses and how to do blood tests to see if people have cancer and teach you more about radiation so you know what you're dealing with. And the reason they're doing all that is they have a question. These guys all know about the contamination of the polio vaccine. But they have a question that they don't want to ask in public. And the question is, if you give somebody a chest x-ray and that person has SV40 in their blood, will you trigger cancer? That one question threatens the use of x-ray in American medicine. And they don't want to ask it in public, but they want to know the answer. So they set up Judy, first in Indiana and later in Florida, in a laboratory where she's got access to radiation, she's got access to human melanoma cells, and SV40. And she is doing these experiments and sending in her monthly reports to Dr. Ochsner in New Orleans. So that's what's going on. She's starting that in 61 is when she graduates from high school, so 62, she's at University of Florida, and everything's paid for, by the way. I mean, Senator Smathers sets this up, her tuition and room and board and all that stuff, because they're hiring her to do this research.
Right.
And then the Cuban Missile Crisis happens October 62, and everybody's, you know, running around with their hair on fire because of that. And then in a couple months later, March, Dr. Ochsner calls Judy down in Florida and says, and Judy's a sophomore at that point in time in college, and he says, how would you like to skip the last 2 years of college and start med school in the fall at Tulane Medical School? We will pay your tuition and room and board and give you a stipend, and you will not have to finish college, and there's just something we need you to do this summer in New Orleans, and this is really important to the country. And add additional advantage, you will be able to work with that great cancer researcher, Dr. Mary Sherman. Would you like to do this, Judy?
And of course she said, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. It's a tough question to say no to, you know?
Right, right.
So they send her a bus ticket. She gets on the bus in Gainesville and goes on into New Orleans. And they've got this whole thing set up for her. They know this is going to happen in David Ferry's apartment. They've got the mouse house across the street. They've got the radiation equipment all there on the federal property. Mary Sherman lives sort of in the neighborhood for all this. And they need somebody who's trained to handle cancer-causing viruses to stand there, kill the mice, cut out the tumors, throw them in the blender, filter out the stuff, and put the extract into the test tubes and make slides and label everything and then clean up this guy's kitchen to laboratory standards and put everything away so it looks like a kitchen and not a laboratory. And then they put all that stuff into a lunchbox, and Judy takes it over to Dr. Mary's apartment. And she's got a key to Dr. Merritt's apartment, so she lets herself in. And sometimes she sits around and reads, but she heads back to her cover job at the Riley Coffee Company, where she's pretending to be a secretary. Well, the other person that works at the Riley Coffee Company at the same time is Lee Harvey Oswald, because Lee Harvey Oswald was sent to New Orleans to take care of Judith Berry Baker. That's his job. Because we know the mafia was working with the CIA. Well, Lee's got one foot in the mafia, that's where he's from, and another foot in the CIA, that's why he went to Russia in the first place. And he is there to be a support person, a babysitter, bodyguard, all that stuff. He gets Judy set up in her apartment. He's got the contacts for that. He gets her set up in the cover job. They start the both of them start on the same day at the Riley Coffee Company on May 10th. And what's happening is her apartment is right down the street from Lee's apartment. So they ride the bus together in the morning to the Riley Coffee Company. And then they go in and act like they're doing work for a while. And then they sneak out and they go over to David Ferry's apartment where they kill the mice, cut out the tumors. And then she takes his stuff over to Mary Sherman's apartment. And then they go back to work. And sometimes Lee doesn't get back to work. And she clocks Lee out. She's got, she is the secretary to the boss downstairs in the Riley Coffee Company, and she's got the right to go up and cut in line and cut every, you know, and clock Lee out at exactly 5 o'clock every day. And the thing is, the Warren Commission, when they started investigating the Kennedy assassination, they put all kind of junk in that 24 volumes. I mean, things like the dental records of Jack Ruby's mother and stuff, you know, didn't have anything to do with the case, but they did not put Lee Oswald's time cards in there.
Hmm.
And the answer is, why not? You know, they put a list of his clock in, clock out times, but they didn't show the time cards. And after the Oliver Stone movie, we got the time cards. And you see what the problem is. Oswald's supervisor was not approving his time cards. The guy approving Oswald's time cards was a fellow by the name of Bill Moynihan, who was an ex-FBI agent, who was working with Dr. Alton Ochsner on this anti-red propaganda operation called INCA.
So, Ed, I'm going to have to stop you for a sec, because this is huge. And I'm not quite sure that I've wrapped my brain around this. And for our listening audience, if you just joined us, I'm speaking with Ed T. Haslam, and his book we are discussing is Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, and Emerging Global Epidemics. If you have a question for my guest, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And so, we've been just trugging along, and this has been a very fascinating mystery that's been unfolding. But now here we are talking about Lee Harvey Oswald working at Raleigh Coffee Company with Judy, who was working for Dr. Mary Sherman, working with Dr. Mary Sherman. Can you prove any of this? Does the book prove this? Do you lay all this out?
Yeah, well, what I was going to say, based on what you just said, but comments, that what this is a short radio interview.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And what comes across, this is a drink from a fire hose.
Exactly, right.
But that's why I wrote a 400-page book.
Uh-huh.
Okay, which is documented like a master's thesis. I mean, everybody talks about how thoroughly everything is documented in there. And what I did not have originally, which I have now, is Judith Vary Baker's autobiography, where in her 600-page book, she was the person who was there, who was doing it, who was at Lee Oswald's elbow, who was working with Mary Sherman, and who was involved in testing the biological weapon on a human, which is a part of the story I do want to get into here, because I think you're going to find some real interesting points here. The summer of 1963 was the focal of the civil rights movement in America. Okay, we had a lot of stuff going on that summer. Churches were being burned, buses were being burned, people were being murdered.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rough summer. And it's also the summer that Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech, which he did on August 28th. Because of that, the Congress on Racial Equality, which was a national organization organized out of the University of Chicago with little headquarters all over the South, had planned a bunch of voter registration drives, primarily for blacks, in areas that they were underrepresented in. And so they had planned, the Congress on Racial Equality, the guy who ran that in Baton Rouge was Ben Cox, had planned a voter registration drive in Clinton, Louisiana, which was the, like the county seat, in Louisiana they call them parishes, but the county seat of East Feliciana Parish. And so what happens is the people who are doing the biological weapon, well, they've killed all the mice and they've started killing monkeys and they're working their way up the evolutionary ladder and they want to test it on a human. Well, where do you get a human you can kill and nobody's going to miss? Well, how about death row and Angola Penitentiary? So they arranged to get one or more prisoners from death row and bring them over to a mental hospital, which is essentially a hospital for the criminally insane. It's not far from, it's about 45 minutes from Angola. And because it's a hospital for the criminally insane, it's got guards and fences and all that stuff. And they need to bring, and it's this is about 4 hours north of New Orleans, they need to bring the biological weapon and somebody to do the injections up from New Orleans to the mental hospital and get on the grounds without anybody knowing what they're up to. And so what they do is they go wait. They decide they're going to go wait in Clinton, Louisiana, right down the road from Jackson, in front of the courthouse, buy a payphone, and wait for the payphone to ring to say that the van has left Angola Penitentiary and is headed to Jackson, and they'll go out, wait on the highway for the van, and they'll get in line behind the van, and they'll show up at the front door of the mental hospital looking like a convoy, and they're using this black Cadillac in order to make them look real official and stuff, and they'll sneak onto the grounds, they'll inject the patients, and then they'll go back to New Orleans, another 4 hours of driving, okay? So this is the game plan, and they're expecting the square in front of the courthouse in Clinton, Louisiana, to be abandoned because it's the middle of the afternoon in August in Louisiana. And when they get there, they drive. I mean, here's the scene. You've got a line of blacks registering to vote on one side of the square. You've got a bunch of, you know, essentially Ku Klux Klan kind of whites with their arms crossed on the other side of the square staring at the blacks. And in the middle, you have the town marshal who doesn't want any trouble.
Right.
And into this scene drives the black Cadillac. And so the town marshal, his name's John Manchester, he looks over at the Cadillac and he's saying, who's this? You know, is it press, government, FBI? Who? You know, so he goes over to the car and says, may I see your driver's license? And the guy says, yes, I'm Clay Shaw from the International Trademark. And then this young white guy gets out the back seat and he goes and stands in line with the blacks to register to vote because he wants to see if they'll let him register because he's white, even though he doesn't live in the area.
Right.
And he goes and signs in, and his name is Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, in the 1960s, when Jim Garrison started investigating the Kennedy assassination, he arrested Clay Shaw for his involvement with Lee Harvey Oswald. And Shaw said, I never knew the guy. And now we have the law enforcement guy in Clinton, Louisiana, saying that Clay Shaw was driving the car that Lee Oswald got out of. And how do we know this? Because the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s subpoenaed John Manchester, the town marshal, to come up to Washington and give congressional testimony, which he did. And they realized that what he was saying was that Garrison was essentially correct, and Clay Shaw was associated with Lee Oswald. Therefore, they instead of telling the people the truth, they stamped that secret and buried it away. And we didn't find out about John Manchester's testimony until after the Oliver Stone's JFK movie,
wow.
And which triggered the JFK Records Act. So we now know that Garrison was essentially correct on his association of Clay Shaw and Oswald, but he was not necessarily correct on the fact that Clay Shaw was involved in the assassination of Kennedy, but what they did not want to expose was the bioweapon project in New Orleans, in which they were using radiation to mutate monkey viruses and then testing it on humans. So the first thing that happens is they go up there and they inject the guy, and then they have to know if it works. So there are blood tests, they're fairly sophisticated blood tests, but you can check somebody's blood about 48 hours after they've been exposed to something to see if the cancer has kicked in. And there's not many people know how to do this, but one of them is Judith Ferry Baker. And so 2 days later, on August 31st, excuse me, Lee Oswald drives Judith Baker up to Jackson, Louisiana, but not in a black Cadillac this time. They're in this beat-up old Kaiser. And for those who have heard that Lee Oswald did not know how to drive, we have 24 witnesses who saw him drive. Okay. So Lee knew how to drive. He just didn't have a driver's license because he wasn't worried about that. But he did apply for a driver's license before the assassination, and he was posthumously granted a driver's license. Okay, so Lee drives her up to Jackson, Louisiana, again, 4 hours up, 4 hours back, and he is seen with her by the barber. I mean, he goes into a barber shop. He doesn't need a haircut, but he goes in there, and the barber says, you know, why is this guy in here? He doesn't need a haircut. And so when he leaves, the barber goes out and watches him get in the car and notices that there is a woman on the front seat of the car. And then one of the things the barber tells him, he says, well, if you want a job over at that mental hospital, you got to go talk to Reeves Morgan. He's got a lot of influence around here. He's the state legislature from this area. So Lee drives out to Reeves Morgan's house and goes in and talks to him. And while he is in there talking to Mr. Morgan, Mary Morgan, the daughter, comes out on the porch, and she looks out at this old green car out there, and she notices there's a woman sitting on the front seat. Well, when Garrison starts investigating all of this, and they hear about this trip to Jackson, Louisiana, they assume that the woman is Marina Oswald, until they interview Marina Oswald, and she said, no, that's not me. And when the Garrison trial ends, the JFK movie's about the Garrison trial, but that's not really how it ends. Right. The way it really ends is they say, we know that there was a woman traveling with Lee Oswald in Jackson, Louisiana at the end of August 1963, and we know it's not Marina, but we don't know who it is, and we wish we did, and we wish we could bring her into this courtroom and ask her questions.
Ed, we have a couple of callers on the line that have questions for you, so we're going to go to the phone line. Good morning, Gary. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yes, the first question is when Mary was found dead, and the police reports, it's been 50 years. Are how many of those people are still alive that you can do research or you can interview about, you know, and why they never, the police department never found the murder or continued the investigation? And what did their family think? Mm. Her family think?
Okay, well, let me try to slice that question apart and take it one piece at a time. One day my phone rang, and this was after I had published my first book, and it was Frank Hayward, who was one of the homicide detectives who investigated the Mary Sherman murder. And he just wanted to talk to me about it. He said, I read your book. He said, back then, 50 years ago, we, the homicide detectives, were focused on motive. He said, we weren't into forensics the way they are today. It was motive was usually gave us the answer, and we just had to figure out who wanted to kill who and why, you know. And he said some other things to me which are irrelevant but beyond the scope of this thing. So that is part of the issue. The second issue is they assumed that the crime scene was Mary Sherman's apartment. Well, that's just where they found the body. That's not where the real crime scene was, over at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. And these guys didn't even know about linear particle accelerators. And they never, you know, they took the word of the coroner. You don't challenge the coroner when you're a policeman, that what really happened to Mary was she was stabbed to death. Well, what really happened to Mary was she was electrocuted and her arm got burned off. And so they had the wrong sort of assumptions in the first place. And the rumors that went around about Mary was that, you know, this was some sort of kinky, violence-oriented lesbian relationship that went really bad, okay? Well, Mary was not a lesbian. I've spoken to her family. She was married at once. She had boyfriends, you know, blah, blah, blah. And those were just uncharitable, you know, kind of rumors that, that go around when something like this happens and makes everybody want to say, well, I met her once, but I didn't really know her, you know, that kind of stuff where they step back. And any rate, so I think, have I answered your question there?
Yes, yes, you did. Thank you. One last question is, you mentioned that cancer is a virus, and there was an Italian doctor who his assumption was, yeah, it's actually a fungus, which is a virus that you can see with the naked eye. What do you think of that theory, that cancer is a virus and or a fungus?
You know, I'm not a doctor, so I make a point of not answering medical questions on the air, and so I'm going to sidestep that one.
Thank you so much for your call. Thank you. Appreciate it. And we have another caller. Hello, Monique. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne. Yes, I was raised in New Orleans, and I'm 56. So this is also the time of my life where I start looking back at my life growing up in New Orleans, mm-hmm. and I do remember the sugar polio cubes, and I do remember Angola Penitentiary. I am also a graduate of Charity Hospital School of Nursing, where there were two universities, medical universities, Tulane and LSU, and I did hear rumors, as nursing students do, about there being experiments on animals that were not exactly legal. And it's just mind-blowing. I mean, I had to stop listening after the first half hour because my jaw just dropped. Really, listening to all of this stuff, and I'm certainly ready to look it up and talk to my brother about it, who was displaced and is now in Texas. But I just wanted to thank you for bringing more light and more truth. Hopefully this is like the real deal, and it's certainly an interesting subject. I was originally drawn in by a female doctor doing cancer research in New Orleans, but it is, it has grown into so much more, so I will definitely be looking it up and bring it to light to some of my friends, because it's nothing more important than the truth, and I thank you for your show.
Well, thank you. And all the information about the book and how to find it is on the website, as well as the Facebook page for Voices from the Edge. So
and
thank you so
much.
And
you can always get it on Amazon, too. And there's also an audio version for those who like to listen instead of read.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you so much for your call. And we have one. Hello, David. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, honey. Yeah, I've been aware of Edward's books for a number of years. I've heard, in fact, I was just listening to one of the interviews Dave Emery did with him just the other night. And I was going to, a comment that would tie to this, germ warfare, and basically what she was working on was a form of germ warfare. And when you think about it, the 1960s were closer to World War One. And there were a lot of World War One veterans still floating around that had gone through, it wasn't germ warfare, but it was chemical warfare, gas warfare, and that had been outlawed, seriously outlawed. That was seen as such an evil, sneaky, dirty business that for the United States government to be involved in it was despicable. And for the CIA to be having a secret facility in a major city and using tax dollars to do it was beyond reproach. And so the idea, and I think Dave Emery probably brought this up in one of his interviews, that that when Garrison tried to do these prosecute Clay Shaw in the John F. Kennedy assassination, the CIA and the chemical warfare industry saw to it that the investigation of Mary's death got squelched very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the germ warfare continued, and then, of course, to you know your guest's contention that perhaps some of these diseases that we've got today, the bad polio viruses, the AIDS, and some of the other diseases have now come about because of this got out of control with, in listening to the interview, not sure if it was on Coast to Coast the other night, but you mentioned that Ferry was basically a psychotic, and he was given, after her death, he kind of took over her work, and kind of, you know, the potential for this germ warfare going out of control because of his psychosis.
Well, if you're going to, I find the idea that they would entrust a biological weapon to David Ferry to be a very scary idea.
Yeah, he was beyond, and you know, drug smuggler, gambler, gun runner, probably a murderer in his own right, and this is a really important book, and it puts a lot of questions up. I just one final thing, Dave Emery, if some of your listeners up there aren't aware of him, he's very into studying fascism. Down here in I'm from San Francisco, and south of us, down in Monterey, was a woman named Mae Brussels, and the Kennedy assassination attracted her right away, and she got a radio show. Dave Emery is kind of a student of hers, and they started discovering that there were a lot of Nazis that were involved in the assassination as well. And this whole idea that the Nazis had gotten into this germ warfare project and that they were basically trying to destroy America through our weapons program, bankrupting us with programs that would constantly go awry or, you know, get out of control or selling our high-tech stuff to the wrong people. This whole scenario of sabotage from within with Nazis.
So thank you. We're going to have to move on. Thank you so much for your call. Edward, did you want to respond to some of the issues that you heard?
Well, one of the things we looked into was who owned these buildings and who owned the what we called the mouse house that had all the 2,000 mice in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that it was the man who started the White Citizens Council of New Orleans, which was a 25,000-member organization opposed to the integration of the New Orleans school system. And that man wrote a letter to the Pope suggesting that the Archbishop of New Orleans be demoted because he was on the side of integration, and the Pope excommunicated the guy as a result. And I find that having the actual house, which was being used as part of the laboratory for this, to be owned by somebody with such strong segregationist credentials is a concern to me about what their real motive for this was.
Mm-hmm. I can understand. And it doesn't go unnoticed that even though we're talking about a story that happened 50 years ago, just with all the recent changes in the law since the Patriot Act has been in place, what you're saying is not unreasonable at all for today. I mean, if you just fast forward 50 years, I would think, I would believe that the CIA was doing something very similar today. I mean, it wouldn't take much to get me there. 50 years ago, however, I think people had a lot more trust that their government was doing what they were supposed to be doing as compared to, I think, today. I think people would be much more open today to an investigation if something like this was happening today.
I agree with you. I think we're waking up, mm-hmm. and I think we need to keep waking up, because democracy just does not work properly if the people doing the voting do not know what the people in power did.
That's absolutely true. And so what's been the most, I mean, this is your third time doing this book, so you know this story very intimately. What's in this rewrite or this update, what was most striking for you?
Oh, the fact that Lee Oswald was going into Mary Sherman's apartment, getting the test tubes, and walking into Juan Valdez's apartment and flushing them down the toilet every night.
Yeah, that is pretty mind-boggling. And so
we also have a memo from J. Edgar Hoover telling his agents not to investigate the Mary Sherman murder.
Wow. Now, that's unusual.
Yes. And there's a note on there that says, you know, her right arm and rib cage were burned off. So-and-so's name was found in her address book. Well, that name is redacted. And I contacted the FBI and Department of Justice and said, hey, guys, I know you're busy, but Freedom of Information, JFK Records Act, all that stuff, and all I need is one name from a 50-year-old memo.
Right.
And they both told me, no, we're not telling you.
Wow.
So whatever it is, they're hiding. And I got the CIA document in there about the family jewels where they're... Jewel number one, which is right at this time, is 100% redacted. I mean, not a single word. It got three pages of blank white squares.
Wow. So what's next? I mean, do you think that there's ever going to be Dr. Mary Sherman's murder will ever be solved?
Well, I think I've done a lot towards... at least exposing the cover-up of it, and that mm-hmm. is part of solving it. And, you know, and the understanding that the people who stabbed her in the heart were her friends.
Right.
That was a mercy killing. And the people that blew off her arm, those are the criminals.
Right.
And so when they, and that whole confusion, you got to straighten that out before you're even able to understand. And then you got to say, why? Because if they want to kill her, there's easier ways to kill people.
This is true. Very true.
So why did they sabotage the linear particle accelerator? Well, they were trying to expose it. And why? Because if you say, what are you doing in there? Why are you mutating monkey viruses? And the answer goes back to, it was in the polio vaccine. And who's holding the roses on that? It's Nixon. I mean, you know, because Nixon was VP when the polio vaccine was released. You know, he's the guy who fires Ovetta Hobby, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. You know,
right.
I mean, this is a battle between political titans that just is being played out in New Orleans. And what I think to me is the most... I'm not sure if the right word is here, but the most important revelation of this is just how little we know or knew about what was going on, and how we can figure it out if we just ask the right questions and don't take the BS answers.
Thank you. I think that's, you know, I think that is probably the golden nugget. It's like it is our responsibility to question our government and to continue to question them when they don't give us answers that pass the sniff test. Thank you so much. This has been such an informative show today. I am so thankful that Edward T. Haslam joined me. His new book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Virus are linked. Thank you so much. I will see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. You don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that glitter is gold? After storm.
And good morning. You are listening to the Mighty Boo, KBOO Portland, just a minute before 9 o'clock. Coming up in just about an hour, it'll be Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15 today, join us for Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, we'll devote the entire hour to a pair of powerful speeches given recently by legendary activists and freedom fighters Harry Belafonte and Angela Davis. At 11 on Between the Covers, we'll hear acclaimed author Dinah Megastu talk about his new book, All Our Names, A Love Story. And at 11:30, we'll hear some special program from WERU-FM about the abuse of Palestinian children in Israeli military courts and prisons. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. Coming up next, we'll hear a special hour-long edition of Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell. Get all the news you're not supposed to know. And then some. That is coming up next on KBOO.
Am I not a woman?
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series. The film to screen on August 2nd will be Mutantes, Punk Porn Feminism. Is pornography an acceptable form of expression? And if so, can distinctions be drawn between different forms of pornography? This documentary raises a number of questions, seeking to provide the answers from the perspective of pro-sex feminism, which asserts that pornography must be wrested from patriarchal control, and that in the hands of women and sexual minorities, it can become a tool of liberation. Again, that's Mutantes, screening as part of the Sex Workers film series, Saturday, August 2nd, at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.